After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Now they could pin the label of communist on Lumumba and his government. The Americans used this weapon in the best possible way. As the Congo was engulfed in chaos, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu removed Lumumba from power in a dismissal order on September the 5th, just 74 days after the central government had taken office. A decision that the prime minister refused to accept. Lumumba went to the parliament and tried to dismiss President Kasavubu. He delivered such a fervent and reasonable speech that both the Senate and the National Assembly voted in favor of Lumumba. Under such circumstances, the prime minister needed to win the global public opinion, so he held a news conference with international journalists to inform the world of his stances. But some of these newspapers described him as Africa's Lenin. The Americans did not stand idle either. Since 1959, they had established a solid and reliable relation with a Congolese army officer called General Joseph Mobutu.
Joseph Mobutu.
Mobutu, who served as chief of staff of the army during the 1960 crisis, had been in constant contact with the CIA station chief in the Congo, Lawrence Devlin, all throughout the crisis. Relations between Mobutu and the CIA worked out well for them. Eventually, and just after 2 months, Joseph Mobutu staged a coup against Lumumba on September 14, 1960, and ousted his government, which was the first democratically elected one in the Congo's history. Meanwhile, the U.S. refused to issue a visa for Lumumba to attend the U.N. session to prevent him from addressing the world directly. Now, the Congo had two governments which both sought recognition from the U.N. Surprisingly enough, Sweden's Dag Hammarskjöld, the then U.N. Secretary General, recognized the coup government of Joseph Mobutu. The Prime Minister's situation was getting worse day by day. Lumumba's house was besieged by UN forces. The UN forces did not even allow him to speak on the radio under the pretext that Lumumba's remarks would aggravate the crisis and would further increase tensions. The communication between the head of Congo's democratically elected government and the people was cut off. Finally, Lumumba managed to escape the UN besiege and headed with his family to the city of Stanleyville, located 2,000 kilometers north of the capital, where Lumumba's supporters were seeking to form a government alongside the coup government. Patrice Lumumba delivered speeches to the people in most of the cities and villages in his escape to the north to inform them about the facts behind the developments in the Congo. CIA agents followed Lumumba all throughout the way. They were looking for a suitable place where the coup army could arrest him. On December the 1st, 1960, as the Prime Minister was crossing the Sankuru River with his family, the spies announced that the time was ripe for his arrest. As Lumumba's boat approached the shore, forces loyal to the coup leader Mobutu got into the boat. Lumumba was taken to the capital aboard a plane, but those who accompanied him forgot that he was the prime minister until just a few days ago. Patrice Lumumba arrived at the airport of Leopold, which was full of reporters. They showed the prime minister to the public in a very humiliating and offensive way, a move which was planned to tarnish his charismatic image. His wife and children were witnesses to what was happening at the airport some meters away. Lumumba, along with two of his cabinet ministers, Maurice Ampolo and Joseph Okito, were sent to the state of Katanga to be executed. Moise Tshombe, Lumumba's archenemy, was looking forward to receiving his guest. On June 17, 1961, the Katanga government, led by Moise Tshombe and supported by Belgian advisors, decided that Patrice Lumumba and his two accompanying ministers should be executed. At around 8:30 p.m., the prisoners were taken to a place in the depth of a remote forest to be executed. Moise Tshombe was present in the place along with his ministers. The soldiers shot Lumumba and his companions dead and then rolled their bodies into a ditch. The coup government spread a rumor in an attempt to answer to the public opinion. The rumor was that Lumumba had escaped in a stolen car and was later arrested and killed by local people. However, the people of the Congo never believed this official account of the incident. The true story about the abduction and execution of Lumumba was leaked after several years. But Lumumba's body could also be highly problematic. He was so popular that the discovery of his body could put his murderers into trouble. Therefore, they decided to exhume and destroy the bodies. The mission was delegated to a Belgian officer called Gerard Sauté. They returned to the place where the bodies had been buried. They exhumed the bodies and after drinking a lot of alcohol, they dismembered the bodies and dissolved them in sulfuric acid. After years of conflict and civil war, Joseph Mobutu wrested full control over the Congo in 1965. After that, Mobutu, who called himself Mobutu Sese Seko, ruled over the Congo for 32 years with an iron fist. He even changed the name of the Congo to Zaire. With Mobutu's seizing of power, the U.S. had found a puppet government in the heart of the strategic continent of Africa for three decades.
Well, Zaire is among America's oldest friends, and its president, President Mobutu, one of our most valued friends. The entire continent of Africa. And we are proud and very, very pleased to have you with us today. Thank you, sir.
Mobutu was one of the world's wealthiest men until 1997, with a fortune estimated as much as $5 billion, while the Congo's population of 40 million had been degraded to one of the world's poorest nations. Mobutu was ousted from power in 1997 by Laurent Kabila, a leader of one of the main rebel groups. He later died of cancer in Morocco. During the civil wars that ensued Mobutu's fall, some 5.5 million of the Congolese people were killed, while millions of others were displaced. Nine African countries and 20 militia groups were involved in the wars, which are remembered as the African World War. Civil war, violence, disease, hunger and poverty were the legacy of the colonialist rule of Belgian King Leopold II, as well as the involvement of the White House rulers in overthrowing the only democratically elected and popular government in this green land. Although in 2002, the Belgian government apologized to the Congolese people for the involvement of its forces in deposing and killing Patrice Lumumba, the U.S. government has yet to apologize for architecting and launching the Congo coup and contributing to Patrice Lumumba's assassination.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: إذا كانت لك حاجة إلى الله فقل: اللهم إني أسألك بحق محمد وعلي، فإن لهما عندك شأنا من الشأن.
Imam al-Kazim عليه السلام stated: If you have a need from Allah, then say, O Allah, verily I ask you for the sake of Muhammad and Ali, for verily they have a special station with you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, in the beautiful conversations of the divinely appointed imams, and in this case, the divinely appointed imam, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that Imam al-Kadhim really, in this dialogue, he speaks about something that is very interesting. He speaks about the disobedience that a human being commits against Allah, meaning how sometimes, unfortunately, may Allah forgive and may Allah forbid, a human being disobeys the Almighty Allah. Now, of course, I'm sure that many of you have heard about the conversations and the dialogues, especially on this program, from all of the divinely appointed imams. But here there is a conversation that the divinely appointed imam, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, the Immaculate Imam, has with his son. In this beautiful conversation between father and son, we find that Imam al-Kadhim says, O my little son, beware that Allah sees you commit an act of disobedience from which he has prohibited you. Allahu Akbar. So much time of our life is spent, first and foremost, in the disobedience of Allah. But second, and what makes it worst, is the fact that we don't even consider that we are disobeying Allah in these large parts of our life. Meaning not only are we committing sin and not only are we committing disobedience against the Almighty Allah, but at the same time, we are negligent of it. We don't even think about it. We don't even realize it. And so here we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam speaks to his son and he says, be very careful that the Almighty Allah not see you committing an act that he has prohibited you. So first and foremost, brothers and sisters, we must know what Allah has prohibited us from. And then we must not do that. And a third very interesting point that comes up here is that we should realize that Allah is seeing us at all times. In some of the definitions of taqwa, piety as is commonly known, this definition is put forth, this awareness that Allah is present, this awareness that Allah sees and hears everything. And so as Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam has said, we must all be very careful that Allah may not see us committing an action that Allah has considered disobedience and that which Allah has prohibited us from. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Tawriya means to make a statement where those who are supposed to get the message in the right way, where the enemies would be misled by that same statement. You know, this is, and if you look at that wasiyyah that Imam wrote, Mansur actually sent a message to his governor in Medina, and he said, find out. Where is his wasiyyat? Whom has he appointed as his wasi? And whoever's name you find there, kill him and send his head to me. So Muhammad bin Sulaiman, who was the governor of Medina, went and inquired about it. And then he wrote to Mansur. He said, the order that you have given to me is impossible to be implemented. Why? He said, I saw the wasiyyat of the sixth imam, and he has named five individuals. The first name is yours, Mansur. The second name is Muhammad bin Sulaiman, the governor of Medina. So I can't implement this order. The third name is of Hamida, the wife of the sixth imam. We know that she cannot be imam or khalifa or nabi or rasul anyway. The fourth name is Abdullah, the older surviving son of sixth imam. And the fifth name is of Musa al-Kazim, the younger son of the sixth imam. Now, if you look at this, imam has already confused the enemies. So they don't know who. And with Mansur's name there, he cannot go and say, kill whomever you find mentioned in this wasiyyat. But the Shias knew that the name of Mansur and Muhammad bin Sulaiman is there just to, you know, misguide the enemies. Confuse the enemy. Hamida Khatun, she is very respected lady in the Shia community, but she cannot be the imam. So you eliminate her name also. Then you are left with two names, Abdullah and Musa. The Shias know Abdullah is older one, Musa is younger one. If the older one was worthy of becoming the imam, imam would not have mentioned the younger one. And so you eliminate the name of Abdullah also. And that's where you get the indication that the waris and the naib and the successor of the sixth imam is none other than Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam. So brothers and sisters, this deen and mazhab has not come to us that easily. Cherish this. Value this. There is sacrifices that which has gone in every generation before this deen and mazhab came to us. It was not that easy for, you know, this deen to survive.
For listening to this episode of Dialogue, don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, a conservative lawyer, John Eastman, has confirmed in a court filing that he had received handwritten notes from former President Donald J. Trump as they strategized about how to keep Trump in power. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, Lawyer Says He Dealt Directly with Trump Over January 6 Plans. Conservative lawyer John Eastman, the architect of a strategy to overturn the 2020 presidential election, dealt directly with former President Donald J. Trump and received handwritten notes from him as the men sought to keep Mr. Trump in power, according to a new court filing. The filing underscored how instrumental John Eastman was in devising ways to fight Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s victory, and how personally involved Donald Trump was in the attempt to keep the presidency in his hands. It also provided further documentation of how members of the Trump campaign and White House aides were involved in these plans. The court filing came as the House of Representatives Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol is preparing for public hearings in June about the attempt to overturn the election. And as more information has emerged about John Eastman's role in advising state officials in Pennsylvania to reject votes cast in favor of Joe Biden. Mr. Eastman did not release the contents of his communications with Donald Trump and others in the White House and the Trump campaign, but he described them in general terms in a court filing in his federal lawsuit in California against the House committee. He is fighting the release of hundreds of documents that the House panel has demanded by a subpoena, including by arguing that some of them are protected by attorney-client privilege. In the court filing on Thursday, John Eastman argued that some of his emails with the White House and Donald Trump campaign were covered by attorney-client privilege because, he said, the people he communicated with were functioning as conduits for or agents of Donald Trump. He said he mostly communicated with Mr. Trump using 6 intermediaries, 3 of whom worked for the Trump campaign and 3 of whom worked directly for the former president while he was in office. But John Eastman said he also spoke directly to Donald Trump, and a court filing stated that Mr. Eastman received 2 handwritten notes from former President Trump about information that he thought might be useful for the anticipated litigation. While Dr. Eastman could and did communicate directly with former President Trump at times, many of his communications with the president were necessarily through these agents. Mr. Eastman's lawyers, Anthony Casso and Charles Burnham, wrote, referring to the six intermediaries. The documents Mr. Eastman is seeking to block from release include the two handwritten notes from Donald Trump, communications with what he called potential clients, including seven state legislatures, who were seeking advice about how to challenge their state's election results, a document discussing various scenarios for January 6, and another document discussing the need to pursue election integrity litigation even in the event of Trump loss for the good of the country. In March, the federal judge in the case ruled that Mr. Eastman and Mr. Trump had most likely committed felonies as they pushed to overturn the election result, including obstructing the work of Congress and conspiring to defraud the United States. The action taken by Donald Trump and John Eastman, the judge found, amounted to a coup in search of a legal theory. At the time, the judge, David Carter of Federal District Court for the Central District of California, ordered the release of more than 100 of Mr. Eastman's emails. John Eastman turned them over to the House Committee as he continued to fight the release of other documents. Among the documents that John Eastman turned over was a draft memo written for Rudolph Giuliani, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, that recommended that Vice President Mike Pence reject electors from contested states in his role overseeing the certification by Congress of the Electoral College results on 6th of January 2021. In their court filing, Mr. Eastman's lawyers wrote that their client disagreed with Judge David Carter's conclusion that he had undermined democracy, arguing that Mr. Eastman truly believed the election was stolen. The filing cited the work of a conservative media figures, including the new film 2000 Mules by Dinesh D'Souza, which fact-checkers have described as misleading, as evidence that widespread election fraud occurred in the 2020 presidential election. If, as seemed clear to Dr. Eastman and his client at the time, there was illegality and fraud in the election of sufficient magnitude to have altered the outcome of the election, then far from undermining democracy, Dr. Eastman's actions and advice must be seen for what they were, a legitimate attempt to prevent a stolen election, Mr. Eastman's lawyers wrote. Perhaps Dr. Eastman was wrong about that, but even if he was, being wrong about factual claims is not and never has been criminal. They added, Dr. Eastman's position remains that his legal theories, controversial though they may have been, were not unlawful. In the court filing, John Eastman said he began working for Donald Trump 2 months before the 2020 presidential election at the invitation of Cleta Mitchell, a lawyer who the January 6th committee said promoted false claims of election fraud to members of Congress and participated in a call in which Donald Trump tried to pressure Georgia's Secretary of State to find enough votes to reverse his loss in that state. Mr. Eastman, Cleta Mitchell, and others began preparing to fight the election results well before Election Day, but the effort kicked into high gear on 7th of November, 4 days after the election, when Mr. Eastman met with Donald Trump's campaign team in Philadelphia to assist with the preparation of an election challenge, the court filing said. In deciding in March that Donald Trump and John Eastman had more likely than not broken the law, Judge David Carter noted that Mr. Trump had facilitated two meetings involving Mr. Eastman in the days before 6th of January 2021, that were explicitly tied to persuading Vice President Mike Pence to disrupt the joint session of Congress. At the first meeting on 4th of January 2021, Donald Trump and John Eastman invited Mike Pence and two of his top aides, Greg Jacob and Mark Short, to the Oval Office. There, Judge David Carter wrote, John Eastman presented his plan to Vice President Mike Pence, focusing on either rejecting electors or delaying the count. That meeting was followed by another, Judge David Carter wrote, on 5th of January 2021, during which John Eastman sought again to persuade Greg Jacob to go along with the scheme.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the laws related to Amr Ma'ruf and Nahi an al-Munkar, which is the concept of enjoying the good and forbidding the evil, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the concept of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil and the jurisprudential statuses, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, about that with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, you know, in the last episode, we actually promised our dear audience to talk about the conditions for enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. After you clarified and kindly elaborated on the very concept of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, and whether it is obligatory or not, that you mentioned that it is obligatory as far as the knowledge is concerned, right?
Sure.
So would you please tell our audience about the conditions? What are the conditions for Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahy anil Munkar?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar, which is translated as enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, or promoting virtue and preventing evil, is without a doubt obligatory when a person sees that felonies are committed, mm-hmm. Offenses are being committed, and evil is being spread by someone, then it is necessary and quite obligatory for according to Islamic Sharia for that individual to take action to stop that evil and to prevent that evil from spreading. And it's the duty of every duty-bound person, every individual who has attained the legal age, the age of legal responsibility. But of course, as I mentioned, the person who enjoins must know the obligatory and haram act, and this is the first condition, mm-hmm. okay? Having knowledge of the obligatory and haram acts is the first obligation. You know, if you do not know what is haram and what's halal, how can you stop it? How can you
tell the difference?
How can you tell the difference? How can you enjoin others mm-hmm. to do good?
Yes.
So one must have proper knowledge of halal and haram, and he should have knowledge of the Islamic Sharia and the Islamic law. Otherwise, he's not obliged to enjoin others. So if one, for example, does not consider an action as haram or obligatory due to ijtihad or taqlid, for example,
right?
Yeah, because there are, we see that there are some, for example, mujtahids who because of their, who because of ijtihad or because of taqlid, does not believe that something is haram. For example, mm-hmm. According to Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, smoking cigarette is forbidden as an obligatory precaution if it causes substantial damage. Okay, mm-hmm. but there is precaution. His
right.
Eminence exercises precaution. According, I know of some religious authorities who believe that smoking is forbidden. Mm-hmm. There's no precaution.
I see.
So one has to know, okay? One has to know whether something is haram or halal, according to Islamic Sharia and according to the religious authority, who he follows. Otherwise, it's not obligatory. So, for example, when it comes to some actions being considered haram or obligatory due to, for example, ijtihad or takhlid, it's not obligatory for another person who considers it obligatory or haram to enjoin that individual.
Yes.
Because he is acting
but
according to
how his... How do they know that, for example, this individual is following another religious authority and then you don't know?
You know, you can, when you, for example, come across such individual, you can either ask him or you probably must know it, you know, if you don't know.
Sometimes it's a personal issue, Sheikh Javid, and yeah. they don't want to express clearly
right.
that they are following, for example, a certain marja, right?
Yes.
So, and it is not incumbent on you to ask other people.
Yeah,
so,
it's not incumbent.
And
okay.
It's not necessary for them to answer you. Right? It's too personal,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is personal. You're right. You know, as long as the issue is clearly defined, for example, no one from any religious authorities considers, for example, drinking alcohol or alcoholic intoxicating
uh-huh,
beverages
yes.
halal, okay?
Right.
And no one considers dogs or pigs pure, okay?
Sure.
So these are clearly defined
uh-huh.
Sharia laws. And when it comes to such things, there's no room for any doubt.
I see.
Okay.
So you
can right away, you know, forbid him. You can just start telling him off, not to, for example, approach impurity,
okay.
not to commit such.
Okay.
Now, that was the first condition.
Yes. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back to further our discussion. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, his hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the concept and the conditions of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, you've are through with the first condition.
Yeah.
And what is the second condition?
The second condition is probability of being effective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you enjoin someone to do good and
right.
forbid from evil, there should be a likelihood of that enjoining to be effective.
Mm-hmm.
And when one thinks that, for example, enjoining can be effective, even in the future, let's say, it is obligatory for him to do so, even if there is a strong possibility that it will not be effective, okay? But there is likelihood, there is some kind of possibility that enjoining could be effective.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a chance or likelihood of that, of your words being effective, because there are stages
mm-hmm.
in Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahy al Munkar. For example, if any of the stage is going to be effective, it is going to well help that individual, for example, do something good
yes.
or stop, refrain from doing something bad
yes.
then that becomes obligatory.
Uh-huh.
And of course, if enjoining another person to do an obligatory act or from doing or forbid from refrain from doing something haram, is not sufficient by a single person. No, one person is not sufficient. There
right.
should be a group of people or
mm-hmm.
many people
yes.
to enjoin. Then it becomes necessary for
right.
for all those people, all
mm-hmm.
those people to join together
yes.
and forbid that person from doing haram thing, or enjoin him to do good things. You know, because the one person may not be as effective as two people. So two people, three people, the more the number of the people, the more effective it is going to be. In that case, all those people have to join together and forbid. And then there's a third condition, to insist on the sin, you know. Sometimes you might commit a haram act, you know, only once for all, you know, once forever. And you are not actually planning, you're not intending to commit that act again and again.
It's a random act.
Yeah, so it happens randomly. So if a person is bent on doing something again and again, then it becomes necessary to forbid that individual.
Uh-huh.
The sinner, according to Supreme Leader, insists on the continuation of the sin, you know. So if it is, for example, known or even probable that he will give up the error without being enjoined, then, of course, it is not obligatory for you to enjoin him, you know, if it is probable.
Okay.
That okay, because he is not intending to to commit it again and again.
And it's not a systematic act of evil.
You're right.
Or evilness. Thank you very much. Is that all?
There's one thing, you know, no vile consequences, no negative consequences. You know, enjoining good is okay, it's obligatory. Forbidding evil is necessary, but it should not have a negative effect. Let's say there should not be any danger threatening you. There should not be any, you know, any negative results. For example, if it is feared that you might be attacked by that individual,
or hurt.
You'll get hurt, or maybe your reputation will be damaged, or your money, you lose your money.
I see.
In that case, it's no longer obligatory.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Shabit, for your nice contribution to this program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the conditions for enjoining the good and forbidding the evil to be obligatory, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much for listening to this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو رحيم محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.